Well, howdy, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans podcast. I cannot be more grateful that you are here. I have a great show for you. Today, I get to sit down with one of the most successful entrepreneurs and restaurateurs in the United States of America, and that is Johnny Carrabba. I am so excited to bring this episode to you, and I want to read to you a little bit about the Carrabba story. Our Gulf Coast experience is about the place where all of our ancestors came to build their lives. They called it America. And they didn't just mean Ellis Island or Little Italy or New York or the north end of Boston or South Philly. They meant the whole damn place, wherever it began and ended, which of course nobody much knew. And it meant an idea too, a big promise in the air during the hard times in Sicily that if you sacrificed just about everything and pretty near worked yourself to death, you could have something a little better, which after all was exactly what you did in the old country without any promise at all. That attitude is exactly what has made Johnny Carrabba one of the most successful people that I've ever had the opportunity of knowing, befriending, and interviewing on this podcast. I cannot wait to bring this story to you. I want to say right now, Johnny, if you're listening, once again, thank you for the opportunity to sit down and visit with, in every sense of the word, a Titan, a Texas Titan, a Sicilian Texas Titan, the first ever on the program. So, folks, thanks again for listening, and please enjoy this conversation with Johnny Carrabba. Well, welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans podcast, and I have a very, very special show for you today. I am here with Johnny Carrabba. How are you, brother?
Man, I'm doing great, man. Thank you for being here.
Oh, gosh. I'm so glad that we're meeting at your restaurant. I mean, of course, and it's funny because, and we're going to talk about this because literally, like we were talking about before we got online, your restaurant, because I know it's a long journey from where it started to the huge scale and to now. We're kind of back where you started this whole thing, right?
Yeah, this is the original, man. It should have never really happened. You know, it's a long shot, but we were here.
Well, okay. So with that, let's just get into it. Tell me where the story begins, and I want to go all the way back to Sicily because I mean, you are. It's one of my favorite things is, you know, a guy who's a U.S. senator, a guy named Ted Cruz. He likes to say that he's a Cuban American Southern Baptist, which is kind of funny. So being a longtime Sicilian Texan, you know, those are some unlikely cultures clashing, and here you are. So take me back to where this incredible story of being a restaurateur, an entrepreneur, and just being a very successful Texan, kind of where does it all start?
Well, I mean, before I go there, you know, it's funny you're talking about Ted Cruz, but there was an old basketball coach named Rick Pitino. You know,
he's a New
Yorker, you know, Long Island guy, Italian guy, naturally. And he always used to tell me, he goes, "Where in the world does an Italian boy get a Southern accent?" He goes, "You look like John Gotti, but you sound like Gomer Pyle." and I've been really kind of reflecting on my ancestors a lot, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm always telling people that I'm a Sicilian immigrant.
Right.
And I like to have that attitude because immigrants are hungry.
Absolutely.
Not to get political, but they're hungry people, you Absolutely. Know, but my ancestors, you know, they very proud Sicilians, but they just couldn't make it in Sicily. It was depressed, you know, mm-hmm. suppressed and depressed. But when they came through, instead of going through Ellis Island like most people did in the United States, they came through the South. So half of my ancestors went through New Orleans. The other half went through Galveston, Texas.
Okay.
And they came here for opportunity. And the only thing we know really is Texas.
Yeah.
And but they were looking for opportunities, you know, for their family, and they sacrificed. And that's the one thing I look at is that, you know, they were hungry people, proud, and they sacrificed their lives to give us, even though we weren't around, but they were trying to give their family this opportunity. And I think they did a great job. So, yeah, so that's how we ended here, you know, they were farmers.
That's what I was going to ask next. Okay, so they become farmers. That's around Bryan, Texas, if I've got it right, where y'all kind of settled, right?
Yeah, the Carrabbas settled in the Brazos River bottom, Bryan, Texas. I have a dish named Chicken Bryan, Texas.
Yep.
That's one of our favorite popular dishes. And I named that dish, you know, just kind of in honor of my grandfather, you know, and They were sharecroppers, man. They picked cotton for a living.
Yeah,
and they did pretty well, you know, because they were true Americans. You know, they believed in a God, they believed in family, and they believed in hard work. And
right.
They left quite a legacy for us.
Now, let me ask you this, because this is something that, you know, and not to be cliche or whatever, there had to have been some incredible recipes. And what was food like? And the reason I ask you that too is because I interviewed an executive chef who's about at the point, Johnny, where you were when your story begins. He's just now opened up his first restaurant where he's really doing, like you talked about offline. What we're going to get into is this is his passion. He has been a sous chef. He's been an executive chef. Now he owns his own place. And he talked about, and as he told the story of his kind of journey, food always had more of an impact than just eating. It reminded him of family coming together, social gatherings. So what did food mean to your family?
I'll tell you. So my two grandmothers were like people that I just can't tell you how much I'll get emotional talking about them. They were selfless people. My grandma Caraba was just the warmest person you'd ever want to meet. Most hospitable, warm, selfless, homemaker, but just great food. Mm-hmm. My mother's mother, her name was Grace Mandola. Mm-hmm. She was the best cook I've ever met. But and I named a restaurant after her called Grace's, you know, which is right across the street from where we're sitting right here from the original Carrabba's on Kirby. But every time I would hang up the phone with my grandma, Mandola, I would say, "Mama, thank you for everything."
Wow.
And she goes, and I'll get emotional talking about it. And she goes, "Oh, Johnny boy," because a lot of Johnnies in our family, I was happened to be Johnny boy. She goes, "But Johnny boy," she goes, "What? I hadn't done anything." I said, "No, you've done everything." I said, "Because without you, I don't know where I would be."
Right.
Now you're saying, why am I talking about this? Well, it's just like your friend that's a young chef. Food is how my grandmother showed their love. Mm-hmm. They cooked from the heart. And I say my grandmas were great cooks. My grandma Mandola was the best cook I've ever met. And all the basis of our food comes from her.
Yeah.
Basically, they're her recipes.
Wow.
Well, then I have three uncles, Tony, Vincent, and Damian Mandola.
Yep.
They are all in the restaurant business. And again, so without my grandma, I don't really know. You know, I'd be probably an accountant somewhere, you know, doing something that I maybe wasn't in love with.
Right, right.
So, but they enabled us, empowered us, man, through their food.
Yeah.
And the family meal was everything.
Yeah.
Sunday meal for us, it was, you know, a two-hour, three-hour ordeal.
Yeah.
But and then every night there was a planned meal, and I think we've lost the art of the family meal. But the family meal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, taught us. That's how we share our love.
So you've got two things there that I hear from your background, man. Just because having that whole immigrant story to tell on the American work ethic, right? And and the just kind of the when people would come into America with just this wonder of this land of opportunity. And then also you have that paired with a grandmother who not only has incredible love for you, but is an artisan in the kitchen, and that becomes so important. So when was it? Was it at a young age that you started helping her in the kitchen? When did you start to develop not only your love of consuming her food, but going, okay, this I want to do this myself?
Well, I never dreamt of doing this for a living. You know what I mean? It happened. You know, life happens, and I'm not really. And me and my uncles and I, we always talk about this. It wasn't that we wanted to be, you know, we're not chefs, but it's not like we wanted to open up restaurants and be cooks. You know,
right.
And we're really good with cooks. I think what happens is, and I don't know if this is going to make any sense to you, Jason, but good baseball players come from good baseball players. You learn, you know, there has to be something with DNA, but mm-hmm. you learn through osmosis.
Yep.
You learn by, like, I didn't know I was learning when I was, my grandmother would have me stir the tomato sauce, what we call suga. I didn't know I was learning,
right.
But then she would have me, "Hey, Johnny, taste this meatball." she was teaching me without teaching
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
And that's the best kind of lessons. But you learn by just being around.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know, you absorb it.
Right.
It bleeds into you. So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, I think you absolutely are, because I think there's a lot of things, like we talked about before we got on. You know, it took me 43 years before I ever decided that I'd be sitting down here with a microphone in front of both of us doing this. And I watched a lot of people do these things, and I would get excited about being around it, you know, in different times of my life. But never did I understand that watching great communicators communicate, watching interviewers interview, and also, like, surrounding myself with people that were doing things that I would like to do, but I'd never stopped to think, well, why aren't you doing that?
Yeah.
You know, it just all of a sudden, it kind of clicks. And so, and then when you do get in those certain instances, I think those are when the life lessons that you did just learn by osmosis. Like my father, you know, he always said your word is your bond. I mean, if I tell you I'm going to do something, we don't need a contract. We don't need, if you don't even need the handshake. I'll give you a handshake, but that's better than any contract you could ever draft.
Well,
right?
you listen to me. What you're saying is exactly what I was telling my son, who's at the University of Alabama right now. I was just telling him this on the phone yesterday. I was talking about my grandfather, Carrabba,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
John Carrabba Sr., right? I'm the third.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He always said, my word is my bond.
Amen.
Just like, same thing your dad told you, but he says, if there was more of me in the town, he goes, we wouldn't need police officers and we wouldn't need lawyers.
That's right.
And that's funny how you learn from those kind of things, you know?
Yep.
You know, and I want to get back a little bit on something, because I was, you know, I have a busy mind and I was kind of thinking about something. But when my ancestors came over, they might have had $2 or $3 on them.
Yeah.
Whatever $2 or $3 meant, you know, back, you know, 1890 to, you know, 1900.
Mm-hmm.
But what they brought over was their food.
Yeah.
And that's how they showed their love.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, too, that if you have, you may not have a lot of money, but those recipes, those are stored in their hearts and their minds, and you can't touch it. It goes back to, like, we were talking about stoicism earlier before we came on. And I love this, the scene from the movie The Shawshank Redemption, where Andy Dufresne, he's been thrown in to solitary confinement for playing music. I believe he's playing The Marriage of Figaro. And they throw him into the hole, and he comes out, and he's in the cafeteria, and he's talking to his buddies, and they say, well, how was it? And he said, it was the easiest time I ever did. And they're like, oh, come on. He said, no. He said, because I had Mozart. And he points to his head, and he said it was here, and he points to his heart, and he said it was here. There are some things that people can never take from you. And if you have that, like your ancestors with the recipes and the ability to craft these meals, that then become something even more special than just, wow, this is an incredible tasty meal. It becomes an experience, and it's an experience of love, right?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
So, okay, so with that history, then what? Now, I found out, and this is a shout out to an employee of yours of 33 years, Bubba, who I got to meet before we started,
yep.
Who said, now, you went to Sam Houston? Is that right?
I did.
Okay, so we're rivals. You know, ask some jacks, but you know, that's all right. We can, I can pay some homage to the Bearcats for at least one afternoon, since you're kind enough to do this interview with me.
Yeah.
And which, by the way, we might as well mention, that's also the alma mater of our mutual friend Brian Clark, who helped make this whole thing happen.
Oh, Brian.
So hello, Brian. So you go to school, and then kind of take me from there through your college years, and then when the actual seed is planted for you to, and I'm not even talking about whether it's a restaurant or whatever. Just there had to have been an entrepreneurial spirit, because you don't get to where you are, because there's a difference, Johnny, as you know. There's a small business owner who owns the job, right? They start a business, they own a job. You have exercised your chops as, if ever there were a, in the Michelangelo sense of the word, an entrepreneur, that is what you've done. So when does that start to develop?
Well, I want to back up to one thing that happened to me when I was in high school. I really wasn't much of a student. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that I couldn't have been a good student, but school just didn't really interest me, and I got by.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think all my teachers used to always tell my parents that, you know, my mother, because mom and dad didn't go to parent-teacher conferences back when I was growing up. It was mostly mom, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they always say, he just doesn't apply himself. But it was maybe I had ADD before they even knew what it was, and I'm not really sure. But I had a little something that happened to me. I have an uncle of mine named Uncle Ciro.
Okay.
And when I was graduating from high school, he says, well, John, you're going to graduate. What are you going to do? And I said, Uncle Ciro, I said, I want to go to school and get an accounting degree, and I want to, you know, be a CPA. And he goes, really? This was a phone conversation. And this is when uncles really were uncles, and right. They, you know, paid attention to you. And he goes, really? I said, I can't see you as being an accountant. And I said, yeah. I said, Uncle Ciro, I have a friend of mine. I said, his dad worked for a Big Eight accounting firm. And I'm going back to like 1977 right now.
Yeah.
And I said, his dad made $225,000 last year. And my Uncle Ciro, like I said, when uncles were uncles, he goes, hey, boy. And how we talk in Texas. He goes, hey, boy. He goes, let me tell you something. You never do anything for the money.
Mm.
He goes, you do something you love and the money will follow.
Oh, wow.
So I fumbled around with about, you know, 5.5, 6 years of college.
Yep.
I'm 18 hours short of my accounting degree. If I back up, I'm really my breed. I don't know if I'm making sense, but we're not really good at working in corporate America.
Yep.
That's not who we are.
I'm with you.
And I was very fortunate because when my grandfather moved from Bryan, Texas, John Carrabba Sr., when he moved from Bryan, Texas, he started working for a soda water company selling sodas, water. Regular Cokes, you know, that sort of thing. And he saved enough money, and he got in the grocery store business. And he had a neighborhood grocery store. So what we're good at, I think, and I think that's where I kind of, you know, learned my cooking from my grandma's, but where I learned from my dad and my grandfather was they owned a neighborhood grocery store.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we're what we call, you know, I don't know if entrepreneur might not be the right word, but we're family-owned neighborhood business kind of people.
Yep.
And that's where I got, I think, what skill I have, good or bad, but the skill I have came from running a shop.
Yeah.
And so my people are good at, I wouldn't say my people are good at Wall Street and that kind of things or being doctors and lawyers, but what my people are good at is, and if you look at Sicilian people, we think about one shop. Mm-hmm. It could be a produce stand. It could be a grocery store. It could be a shoe store. You know what I mean? But that's what we do.
Right.
And I think it's just DNA.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but
you know, I don't know if I don't know. Don't let me get off on tangent. I get so excited to talk to you that I might talk about other stuff that doesn't make sense.
Hey, brother, we talk about anything you want to talk about because it's your story and that's where the good stuff comes out. And I can absolutely relate because I always tell people this. The greatest job I ever had was whenever I was in school in Nacogdoches at SFA. I worked for Mize Department Store, which was the neighborhood or rather the community department store. And the cool thing about it was, Johnny, it wasn't a place where you just came in and people looked at suits, and got one and you went and rang them up. No, I had a book of business. I had to fit people for suits. And so therefore I, at the age of 19, am having to tell a 50-year-old guy, hey, here's how much linen you want showing out from that coat sleeve. Here's how much you want to cinch the waist up. Do you want cuff or no cuff? Here's the pros and cons of each. So you learn to communicate. And I and my father would never have lasted in corporate America because we're people. And you saying that you're ADD, I'm there with you. I'm the same way. And most entrepreneurs, there are studies that show that ADD is common amongst entrepreneurs, but whenever you line them up with what they're passionate about, that's why they're so successful.
Right.
It's like this energy just bursting, but then once you channel it, our mutual friend we mentioned earlier, Brian will tell you. I mean, he's a million miles a minute, but you put him on a real estate development idea that he thinks is a good one, watch out, buddy. A lot of people are about to make money because that's his passion. That's his focus.
He zones in.
Absolutely. So I completely think that that's the deal. And another thing that I want to hear you talk more about, because this is one of the things that I'm constantly talking about with this audience that I have realized in my life and what I preach to my daughters is that idea of first find what your passion is. Find what drives you. I've said it 100 times on this podcast. You may find a passion that only yields you $40K a year. But guess what? If you're really passionate about it and you love it, you will create a lifestyle that costs $40K or less a year so that nothing can keep you from doing that thing. And I got to believe you can relate to that, that you are not going to go work in corporate America once you figured out that you needed to be right signing the front of the check and not the back, that you were going to be an entrepreneur, right?
I like that with Jason. I never heard that one.
That's the truth. And that's what I tell people. You will figure – a lot of people think they want to be that guy that signs the front of the check. And a lot of them think they want it, and then they do it, and then they've signed the front of so many checks, they go, please just let me have that direct deposit every 2 weeks again.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm glad to hear you know, with the way you talk to your two daughters. If my son Johnny and my daughter Mia were here right now, I'd ask them, what have I been telling y'all since y'all were 6 years old? I mean, I said, I care what you do, but I really don't care what you do. The only thing I ask for is you live by the golden rule.
Yep.
And what I really ask you to do is do something you love.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should say this or not, but I said, Johnny, I don't care if you're a fishing guide the rest of your life.
I'm with you.
Right? And nothing wrong being a fishing guide if that's your passion.
That's right.
But, you know, everybody expects my kids to get in my business. I tell them, I want you to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Because it's all about what gives you joy.
Absolutely.
And whatever gives them joy is all that I'm after.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I'm the same way. Like Abby, my youngest, who's at the University of Colorado, she loves cooking and nutrition. And man, I got to tell you, she made a French onion pasta and some bruschetta.
Ooh.
I'm telling you, if you ever need a line cook, Abby's your gal. And I've told her that. I was like, again, just because I've kind of been the entrepreneur that most people, again, that they look at you and they think, well, your kids should either come into your business or they should go out and own a restaurant and scale something up and make it big and have their name all, you know, over 300 units all over the country. And I've told Abby, I'm like, if you love to cook, find a way to make your living cooking. And by the way, if you love it enough, you may look up one day and you may be like a Carrabba's. You may be, or you might be blogging and writing about it, but it doesn't matter. You're doing what you love.
Right.
Rylan, the same thing. University of Alabama student. I told her before she went off, I said, sweetheart, I said, you've got something going for you. I said, you have a great personality. You're magnetic. I said, and you say you want to be in sports broadcasting. You're about to go to the dynasty of college football, of course, not this year, but I said, go and build a following there. Just do what you love and watch. All you need, you know, Kevin Kelly has this incredible article called 1,000 True Fans. And that's the whole thing it's about, Johnny, is it's finding, if you can find 1,000 people that believe in what you're doing and that are as passionate about what you are passionate about as you can make a living. And it starts there. So I love that. And also it confirms that mantra when I see what you've developed and then to hear that, because rarely ever do you find someone that has had your success and has opened this many stores and they go, well, you know what? I just wanted to make a buttload of money.
No.
And I thought I could do it with my grandmother's recipes and look at me now. That no. doesn't work. That is, mm-hmm. That does not work.
No.
Right?
When we talk about this, you know, we talked about this earlier, but not on the podcast, but just privately, right? Whenever I get money oriented or goal oriented for money, it never works. But when I work in the present moment, mm-hmm. and I do what I love doing, the money usually follows. But no, what we're talking about is so true.
Yeah.
You know, and what we tell our kids, do what you love.
Yeah.
Just like my Uncle Ciro said, I'll repeat myself. Don't ever do anything for the money. You do something you love, and the money will follow. Money is and I don't know how important the money part of it is, but money is just a byproduct of doing something great.
Absolutely. I think that very well said.
Yeah.
Very well said. So when does it come into play? When do you open the first store? And it's you and Damien started together, right? So
mm-hmm.
kind of take me through, not just right there, that moment when y'all, you know, signed the paper, signed a lease, or built a bought property, but kind of the conversations leading up to it that made you make that decision.
Well, I have to kind of go back a little bit on you.
Okay.
My uncle Tony Mandola, he's 10 years older than I am. He was dating a young lady by the name of Phyllis Lorenzo.
Okay.
They're married now. Phyllis Lorenzo's mother and dad owned a tortilla company. She was half Italian, half Mexican.
Okay.
And they owned a tortilla company called Rio Grande Tortilla. And my Uncle Tony was dating Phyllis and, you know, delivering tortillas to grocery stores and things like that. Well, suddenly the father died. Mr. Jack Lorenzo passed away. Well, the mother had five children. She couldn't really afford to pay for these kids, you know, on this tortilla company. Left her kind of like a little bit in a bad fix, right? Well, so she ended up opening up a little Mexican restaurant on Navigation Street here in Houston. That lady's name was Ninfa.
Oh, really?
So she started this little small, she started this little small restaurant, about 9-11 tables in it. And nobody had ever heard of a fajita here in Houston,
but
she's the one that, you know, made a name. So my Uncle Tony worked for her, and that was a big success story.
Wow.
Well, so then by this time, Tony breaks off from them, and he opens up a restaurant with my other uncle, Vincent.
Okay.
They open up a restaurant called Nino's. Then Damian Mandola, who's only 6 years older than me, my other uncle, I know I'm talking about a lot of uncles and a lot of whatever, he was going to Sam Houston, and he wanted to open up a restaurant. So he opened up a restaurant called Damien's in Huntsville at about 21 years of age.
Wow.
And so I went to Sam Houston, and I worked for him. But
okay.
Just I was going to college to have a good time, and I would go I'd work in the kitchen, and that didn't really last long because it was hot in the kitchen, and I wanted to kind of – I would see the girls walk by, so I'd much rather have fun, right? Whatever.
Right.
And but anyhow, so I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate in the sense that when I was going to college, I moved back to Houston, and my old high school coach called me up. I don't want to ramble on you, but he called me up and said, "Johnny, here you're back in town." He goes, "I could use some help coaching this year at St. Thomas High School here in Houston." And so I ended up being the JV football coach and the JV baseball coach for 2 years. In the meantime, I was only making $400 a season for that. And it's not to say that I needed all the money in the world, but I had my parents still kind of support me while I was trying to finish up this accounting degree. But my uncles would always call me, "Johnny, we need a bartender. Johnny, we need a waiter. Johnny this, Johnny that." Well, one day I'm waiting tables at a little place that my Uncle Tony owned. It's called Tony Mandola's Blue Oyster Bar, and I'm waiting tables, shucking oysters. And he came up to me on a Friday. I never forget it. He goes, "Johnny," because I just signed a lease on a second location. He goes, "I want you to be my general manager." And I was 23 at the time.
Wow.
And I said, "Uncle Tony," I said, "man, I'm really flattered." I said, "but I don't even know how to wait tables yet." You know, he goes, "yeah." He goes, "Johnny," I think you have what it takes. It's always somebody believing in you.
Absolutely.
And maybe he was just desperate. I don't know. But he goes, I know you have what it takes. He goes, "and I want family there." I opened up this restaurant for him, and he did me a huge favor.
Wow.
I never really saw him that much at this location. And it was sink or swim, survival.
Yep.
And I went back to what I learned from my grandfather and my father at the grocery store. I treated it like it was mine because we have that ownership mentality. Mm-hmm. I ran it like a little family-owned neighborhood business.
Yeah.
And I'm running that restaurant. And then Damian Mandola, who had moved to Houston and opened up a really great restaurant in downtown Houston on Smith.
I've been there. I mean, that's
great restaurant.
Damian's is unbelievable. Yeah.
But on his way home, us restaurateurs, we eat late at night because, you know, we feed all of y'all.
Right.
And then late at night, it's our time to eat.
Right.
And he came in one night, and he's such a great visionary. He had just got back from New York, and he was telling me about his New York trip and all the Italian restaurants that he went to. And he painted me a picture of what he wanted to do here in Houston.
Okay.
At the very end of that conversation, he goes, "You want to do it with me?"
Wow.
And I was, again, just like when my Uncle Tony asked me to be a general manager of his place and my Uncle Damien's asked me to be his partner, I was very flattered.
Yeah.
Because when your uncles you look up to and they have that confidence in you, it makes you feel worthy, right?
Heck yeah.
But I had issues. Because he's recruiting me from his brother, who happened to be my other uncle.
Right, right.
But I called him later on that night once he got home, and I said, man, I'm really interested. And that's how the Carrabba's deal started.
Wow.
Now, the Carrabba's story, it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
And I can talk about that whenever you're ready, but that's how this happened. And but you never know how your fate. You never know how life's going to turn out. I just happened to be maybe at the right places at the right time.
Yeah.
But that's how we got into, and that's how we started Carrabba's. But the Carrabba's story, Jason, is really kind of a miracle.
Let's go.
Well, what happened was, so when Damien met me that night, I went to go work for him, and I worked in the kitchen at Damien's, and I really can't thank my uncles enough, but my uncle Damien's an artist and a great visionary. So he painted me this picture of, open kitchen, wood-burning pizza oven, which nobody had ever seen in Houston then. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sauteing going on, a casual restaurant, not formal, but casual and fun, And so we went to a bank. We had a business plan, and we went to a bank. And the bank was a bank that my grandfather, my dad, did business with. And we go see a guy by the name of Mr. Chip Allen, and the president of the bank, and we talked to him about our dream. And he pulled me aside, in this meeting that me and Damien were in. He goes, Johnny, I've been knowing you since you were born. He goes, matter of fact, this is when bankers were bankers. Mm-hmm. Not to say that I have banking friends, so I'm not saying you're not bankers, but.
But they knew you. They knew DNA from which you came.
It was hands-on business
Absolutely.
Back then, right?
Absolutely.
And he said, matter of fact, he goes, I was there the day you were born because I brought your parents a gift for you at the hospital. He goes, Johnny, I can't let you do this. He goes, 1986, the worst economic times in the history of Houston. He goes, and you want to get in the toughest business known to man as the restaurant, highest risk business in Atlanta. He turned me down. But when you're young, I was 27 at the time. But when you're young, you really never really want like an older guy telling you that you can't do something.
Exactly.
So I get in my car and I said, Damien, I'm not worried about him. Let's just, we'll continue to go. Well, second bank turned us down. 9 banks turned us down. So it's the dream is like gone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want you to listen to the story. One day I'm in the kitchen at Damien's cooking. 9 banks have turned us down and I'm deflated. Ego is shot and whatever ego I had back then was shot. I get out of the kitchen, I'm walking through the dining room, and I see these two gentlemen, older gentlemen and a younger guy, sitting at a table, and I said, hey, how are y'all doing? Everything good today? How everything's going? And just doing my deal, right, as restaurant people do. And the man goes, Johnny, how's your new deal working out? And I said, sir, I really didn't know his name.
Uh-huh.
I said, it's not really going that well. I said, banks have turned us down. I didn't have the nerve enough to tell 9 banks turned. I said, but banks are turning us down. I said, I think we're just going to put it on hold right now until the economy gets better. Mm-hmm. He goes, well, hold on for a second. He reaches in his back pocket, pulls out a business card. He goes, I'm on the board of this bank called Omni Bank over there by University of Houston. He said, and I want you to go look, see this woman. Her name is Rhonda Lewis. Tell her that Ralph Minchin sent you. So I call Rhonda Lewis up. Well, she goes, okay. She goes, I can meet with y'all on Monday. Damien and I, put on the best suit we can put on. Uh-huh. We go see another banker. We go see another banker. And when we walk into the bank, I walk up to the front door and I said to the receptionist, and I said, yes, ma'am. I said, I'm Johnny Carrabba. This is my uncle Damien Mandola, and we're here to see Rhonda Lewis. Well, Rhonda Lewis walks down the middle of this old-fashioned bank, down the lobby of the bank, and when she comes up to me, I put my hand out to say, Rhonda, I'm Johnny Carrabba, and she doesn't shake my hand. She hugs me. And I know we're in Texas, and I know we're huggers,
yeah.
But I'm saying, wow, where do I know her from?
Right. Right.
And I said, well, this is my Uncle Damian Mandola. Well, she gives him a big hug. To get to the point, we go back into her office, and we're telling her about our vision and our dream. Mm-hmm. It's really Damian's vision and dream, and I'm just going to be the sweat, the partner that runs the thing.
Right.
Well, she goes, well, let me tell you something. Our bank loves to lend to family-run businesses, and we love to lend money to native Houstonians. We're an old Houston bank. She goes, but I'm a little confused. Who's going to run this thing? And Damian goes, it's the name of the restaurant's going to be called Carrabba's, because Damian's last name is Mandola. This is Johnny's restaurant. And she goes, well, Johnny, the little blue Tony Mandola's Blue Oyster Bar you run, that's me and my fiance's favorite little restaurant.
Wow.
And she goes, and Damian's restaurant on Smith Street is our favorite restaurant. That's where my fiance proposed to me at.
No way.
So are you getting my point?
Yeah.
So I want to wait until later in the podcast to tell you this, but I can't wait to tell you this. So when I'm doing my orientations with my new employees, and I would like to add in the Outback story in this, but we'll go there later. But there's one thing about it is that I tell my children and I tell everybody that I orientate in my company, is you got to play, like Joe DiMaggio says, I play the game, Joe DiMaggio, the old great Yankee, right?
Yeah.
Base center fielder. He goes, I play the game of baseball hard every play. He goes, because there might be somebody in the stands that has never seen me play, and I want to impress them.
Wow.
Well, so you're saying, Johnny, why are you telling me this? Well, first of all, I think I played hard. I'm nothing special, but I played hard. Mm-hmm. My uncles had enough confidence in me to ask me to be in business with them. My coaches at St. Thomas asked me to come back and coach. Mm-hmm. Not that I was a good athlete at all. I was small but slow. But you'll catch that later.
I got you.
And then, but then I have to look at Mr. Ralph Minchin. I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. Rhonda Lewis. I didn't know him. Rhonda Lewis, I mean, I didn't know her.
Yeah.
But guess what? They believed in us.
Yeah.
And so you never know. Again, I'm repeating myself to you, though, Jason. You never know who controls your fate.
That's right.
And that's why you have to play hard every day.
Amen.
You know?
Amen.
And you don't play hard just for the fans or whoever. You play hard because it really makes you feel good.
Absolutely.
You know, and good things will happen.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the thing. There are people watching when you don't even realize it. And Johnny, I've seen that throughout my career. And it's, again, it goes back to one of the reasons, like when I started the podcast, one of the things that gave me the confidence to do it was, I keep mentioning Brian because he's a friend of both of ours, but mentors like him that have watched me at different points in my life, whenever, like you say, I was just trying to show up and be the hardest worker, play the game the best I could or whatever. And when it came time to start this podcast, all of a sudden I had these amazing people that whenever I shared this crazy idea with them, they're like, sure, Jason, I'll introduce you to so-and-so. I'll help. And it's like, you know, I guarantee you if Brian thought I was going to embarrass him, he would not have arranged this meeting with you. And and what I take from that, because I know you're a humble guy, your uncles knew you as well or better than anybody, and they always said, Johnny, here are the keys to our dream. Here are the keys to our livelihood. That is an honor, my man. And so I think that's incredible advice. And that's a thing that you just don't see so much. You don't see as much as you used to. I mean, my dad was like that. When I worked on a job site, because he built houses, he would say, no pissing. No, that's talk about Texas term. No piss ain'tin'. You know, don't work like a piss ant. Don't work. Yeah,
it's so, I like that.
No, he said no piss ant. He said you get out there and you work. And I mean, he would make us do the bottom of the trough jobs because, and that's where we started. You know, he had a tire store, and I mean, I was shucking tires and filling cars up whenever I was about 11 or 12 years old. But I learned more from those, that work ethic and just carrying that on. And you know, I the first company I ever bought, I paid it off a little early in the first, and my dad was hard on me. You know, I mean, that's how, we came up. You had to work for what you had.
As that generation.
Absolutely. And I remember, you know, I called my dad up and I thanked him for, you know, that being hard on me, not making, if I wanted to, if I needed money for something when I was growing up, and you can probably relate to this. I could probably have asked my father for it, but there's no way I was going to. And if I did, it must be really, really important. It wasn't for a new bike, you know, just because. No. It had to be. And I think that's just that's something that's kind of lost. So everything you're saying, I totally get. And I'll be honest with you, I miss the days of bankers who, like you said, they understood you, your work ethic, and they looked beyond.
It was personal.
It was personal. It wasn't just, what do you look like on paper? They like, I know who you are in the flesh. I know who you are at the heart of you. So yeah, I'll roll the dice. I'll back you.
Yeah, you gamble on people.
Absolutely.
But it's not a gamble when you know you're doing something with people, good people, you know. But you know, I forgot like an important part to this story though. And you know, when I say Carrabba's was a miracle, it should have never happened. You know, when 9 banks turn you down in the worst economy in a town's history, but the bank needed $100,000 of collateral. Damien didn't have it because he was just starting Damien's, and I naturally didn't have it. But that's when I called my dad. Mm-hmm. And my dad co-signed a $100,000 CD, but it gets even better than that. So when I say Carrabba's should have never happened, we open up on December 26th of 1986. On December 25th, which is usually Christmas, I was sitting next to my dad at the family table with the whole family there, and I had to ask my dad. I said, "Dad, I said, do you have any money on you?" He goes, "Well, yeah." He goes, "But what do you need money for?" I had to borrow money from my dad to open up the cash register.
Wow.
You know, yeah. And my dad gave me money that day. And it's not to say maybe I know I wasn't dead broke, but I know I couldn't have got to. I couldn't get to the money. Maybe it was in the bank in a little, sorry, little savings account. Maybe I had.
Absolutely.
But again, you know, Carrabba's was a long shot, man.
Yeah.
You know, and people can look at it now. People can look at it now and say, "Oh man, that's great."
Yeah.
But they don't know the pain and they don't know the road, the marathon that we've had to run.
Yeah.
That's what people don't really. A lot of people don't. Young people especially. They don't know that. They look at the end product.
Yep.
They look at a great athlete or a great actor or a great business person and say, "Oh man, that person just did it." No. Yeah. No.
And that's I'm so glad that's a perfect segue, Johnny, because it's one of the things I try to uncover with every podcast. Because when I talk to entrepreneurs, one of my favorite stories is I had a podcast guest, very successful tech entrepreneur, who when he was just starting out, he had a dilemma. He owed the IRS about $250,000, but he also had to make payroll. And he's in this quandary. Who do I pay? The government or my employees? He chose to pay his employees.
Right.
Well, his wife, he's overseas trying to make a sale. And his wife has her entire paycheck garnished by the IRS, and she did not know they were in trouble.
Oh.
And so, I mean, like, and when he was sitting where you are, not in this restaurant, but when I was interviewing him, he literally choked up going, that taught me a lot about communicating with my first partner in this business, which was his wife, and just remembering that those struggles, people, like you said, they come and they see Carrabba's nationally, they see that they don't remember or they don't know the story behind the story. So that's what I want to dig into, because I remember what it was like when I remember laying tile in my office building that I couldn't afford. I was with you, man. I had leveraged myself to the hilt after I left Houston and bought my first business, and I'm laying tile in the bathroom at 2 a.m. with one of my employees, because I have to have the toilets back in place before the ladies come in to work. They can't go, you know, the guys, I could just leave a urinal on the wall and they could do without a toilet for a day.
Yeah.
The ladies couldn't do that.
Right.
So, and so I remember those times, and where you go, I don't know how I'm going to make it to the next month. So tell me after, and by the way, another thing I want to mention to you, because I had another guest on the podcast who went through a similar deal with his father. His father basically mortgaged everything he had to get his son started, and he got real emotional talking about that. But now you're trying to start in a very difficult economy, a very difficult business, and you don't want, I can imagine, I don't want to speak for you, I want you to talk about this, how it figured in. You got a lot of people you don't want to let down that believe in you. You've got your dad, it's $100,000 on the hook, plus the till, you know, Damien and all your uncles who have always said, Damien, Johnny, we believe in you. So talk to me about those early days whenever it is your baby and the struggles that you had.
Well, I mean, when my dad co-signed the $100,000 CD, that was really basically Damien's idea. Mm-hmm. I never really wanted to ask my dad to co-sign it, you know, right. And because I know how hard my parents had to work. You know, they had my dad was a butcher. My mother was the cashier at this little neighborhood grocery store. And it was kind of a grocery store. It was a very neighborhood. All the neighbors had credit. But they'd come in and say, give me 5 slices of bologna. Give me 4 slices of cheese. We had to get the cheese out, the bologna out, ham or whatever, slice it. Bubble gum was a penny back then. So the grocery store is a business of pennies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I just know that my parents, there was a mom and pop store. I know how hard they had to work. I also know that I wasn't going to lose their money. Mm-hmm. And then Damien also, you know, he was putting his neck on the line. And my deal is I just never want to – I think I kind of got this, you know, through my DNA. I don't want to let anybody down, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And yep. And so I worked extra hard. I wanted to prove some banks wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, you always Absolutely. Have to, you know, I think sometimes you do your best work when you have a little bit of a chip on your shoulder.
Absolutely.
And a lot of those bankers are still my customers, and I can kind of, they, you know, we laugh about it now, but I wasn't laughing at the time.
Right.
But they were doing what they had to do. But I just didn't want to let mainly I didn't want to let Damien and my dad down, my parents. I think I've always had like a little bit of deal where I want to prove people wrong also. I've already mentioned that, but I'm going to give you a little story about the way I kind of treated my business and the hard work I think I put in. My son, who's a sophomore at University of Alabama, but when he was in high school, it was time for him to get to work. And I put him just like your dad did with you. We talked about that earlier, Jason, right? And I put him in the dish pit. Mm-hmm. And so we get in the car one day, and he got his first paycheck. I think I was paying him $11 an hour, which is kind of overpaying for dishwasher. No, but my dishwasher make more than that. But anyhow, but get to the point. I won't joke about him right now. But he gets in the car and he goes, "Pop, I got my first paycheck." I said, "Really, man? That's great." I said, "How much was it?" And he said, "Whatever the amount was, I can't remember." And I said, "Well, how many hours did you work?" And he said, "Man, I worked 74 hours." I said, "That's great, but that's a 2-week pay period."
Yeah.
Right. So it's less than 40 hours a week. But whatever, he's washing dishes.
Right.
Because I want him to learn from the ground up. And he goes, "Let me ask you a question. How many hours did you..." I still work a lot of hours, but how many hours did you work when you opened up?
Yeah.
I said, "Well, you have your phone on you, don't you?" I said, "Well, get the calculator part of it on." I said, "Go 8 in the morning till midnight, 5 days a week. Then I want you to go from 8 in the morning till 1 in the morning on the weekends, 2 days a week." Well, I think that added up to 118 hours.
Wow.
I said, "That's what I did for 2 straight years, 7 yeah. days a week."
And by the way, Johnny, let me ask you, how many paychecks were you taking home during that time?
None.
Exactly.
None. I didn't get paid.
Yeah, I knew it.
But you're so right about that.
Yep.
And so it's talking about the pain part of it. I was in the hunt. Mm-hmm. I wasn't counting hours.
Yeah.
I just knew I had to be here.
Yeah.
I was pretty much the only one with the keys to the joint.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So open the door at 8 in the morning, get my deliveries. And I was here late at night with my busters to make sure the dishwashers, to make sure the restaurant was clean. This is a brutal business.
Yeah.
Right? It's not no 9-to-5 deal.
Yep.
5 days a week. But I can remember, when I look back, I can remember three times for sure that I would get a milk crate, and I would sit in my walk-in cooler, refrigerator. And I'd sit on the milk crate, and I remember 3 different times breaking down and crying. Yeah. And I didn't think I could make it. I didn't think I could do it. I can start crying right now thinking about it. But I just didn't. I was mentally fatigued, mm-hmm. sleep deprived. I didn't think I could do it anymore. That's how hard it was. But now when I look back, it's kind of like running a marathon. When you're running the marathon, I'm sure you're not having that much of a blast. You're achy, hurt, your feet hurt, knees hurt, back hurts.
Yeah.
But when you freshen up and you look back on,
yep.
You really really love it.
That's right. That's why they all. I could not agree more. That's why a true entrepreneur will always. You know, they may gripe. They may moan. I was that guy. I mean, it was the same thing, man. I shed tears, going, I don't know what I have done. I made the comment, and you know, Lord forgive me for saying it. I said in that first year of business, if I'm diagnosed with cancer, I will not seek treatment. And that is a true story, man. You know, and here I am. I'm supposedly living the American dream. I'm 28 years old and got my own company. And I mean, just miserable. But now I wouldn't change a thing. I look back and I go, God, give anything to have that experience all over again. And you mentioned it. That's why marathon runners, they rarely just run one. You ask them 2 minutes after the marathon, I would never do that again. And then before the day's over, they're preparing for the next one.
You're right.
You ask a woman who's given childbirth, you know, oh my gosh, that was, I don't know if I could ever do that again. And they have more kids. You know, it's in that moment you look back, and it's those things that really challenge us and stretch us that a lot of times are those great experiences as we look back on them.
So. Yeah, but you know, it's like this right here. You know, I have an analogy, but it's like everybody thinks, and I have about 10 kids, you know, college kids, sure, maybe a little older, a little younger.
Yeah.
They think they want to get in the restaurant business, or they grew up in the restaurant, and their parents say, go talk to Johnny about different things. So I have about 10 kids that I mentor,
yep,
right? And I'm always talking to them about this. But everybody thinks the restaurant business is so glamorous. I get to talk to customers, and I get to wine and dine. They don't know that the work, and so my analogy is like, I always talk about this, and I use this with my kids that work with me. I always say, nobody really ever knows what the heavyweight champion of the world goes through. Mm-hmm. They think, oh, that, you know, they have the belt, they make the big payday from, you know, fighting in the championship fight. And there's a couple of analogies here. First of all, nobody knows that young boy, most of the time, heavyweight champions are men, but boy, they don't know what they did at a young age. They don't know how many times they had to wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning, go do the road work, how many times they had to spar, and they kept on getting knocked down, get up. But nobody really sees that.
That's right.
Nobody sees what they had to do to get there.
Yeah.
But then the analogy that I want to bring that further is that once the heavyweight champion gets there, guess what? The journey's not over, because when he starts acting like a fool or acting like he's accomplished something, he usually gets knocked out.
That's exactly right.
So once you get to it, once you get there, you're not there.
That's right. That's right.
And so Nick Saban, you know, there's a great deal I watched the other night. It's on HBO. It's The Art of Coaching, and it's Bill Belichick, the New England coach, and Nick Saban, Alabama, great coach. And he always says that, you know, climbing the mountain is one thing. Reaching the top, he goes, what happens? You reach the top of the mountain. He goes, you become the mountain.
Mm.
And so that means you have to keep on, you know, you have to keep on going.
Absolutely.
You're never, you know, people say, man, you know, they talk about success.
Right.
I don't really know the definition of success.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe some people can say, yeah, you've been kind of successful in the restaurant business, but I don't feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, because there's.
Yeah, once you get content, that's whenever.
I know I'm rambling on you, but
no, that's,
you can't get content.
No, that's great. Well, and a quote you're going to love that Phil Burks, that I mentioned earlier, he gave me this quote when you're talking about having Johnny add up the hours that he had worked. Entrepreneurs are the only people that will work 100 hours a week so that they don't have to work 40. You know, think about that. And that's the truth.
You have to send that. Would you send that to me?
Absolutely. But that's, and it's the best way to describe a real entrepreneur, because, well, I mean, how many times whenever you just had the restaurant for the first, I know this was the case for me, is I would look, and I had written myself lots of checks, but they were the only ones that never got cashed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, but you know what the best thing about my son, Johnny, asking me how many hours I worked, that was the first time, and that was, you know, we're 33 years in business, right?
Yeah.
And this was about 3 years ago, so I was 30 years in business, and it was the first time I ever added up the hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't count hours when you're passionate.
No.
Or you own something.
No, no, you're doing it because of the love. I could not agree more. All right, so you make it through. I mean, you've literally, you've shed tears, you're figuring this thing out. but all of a sudden you catch your stride. Now take me through whenever you realize not only are you do you have a good product, the food is good, but you also understand how to run the business. And you take me through the timeline, whichever way makes sense. Because, I mean, literally, Johnny, you did something that there are a lot of still here in town that I've been to. There, the one restaurant where that's it. It's a mom-and-pop neighborhood deal. But you took this. This is what I'm always interested in learning is how you take something so intricate as food, which now you've got to please a lot of people, and then put it on a massive scale the way you did. Kind of take me through the trajectory of when that all
happened. Well, what happened was is that, you know, I had the one restaurant on Kirby Drive, and then Damien came to me one day and said, Johnny goes, he was a visionary, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, this Carrabba's thing, man, he goes, it has legs. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do you mean? I didn't know what legs meant, mm-hmm. you know? He goes, it has legs, it means it can travel.
Yeah.
He goes, I think you need to look for a second location. So I opened up in 86, this is 1988.
Okay.
And this is back when I was working the 130 so many hours a week.
Right.
And I would never think in that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that this one Carrabba's restaurant was going to be mine, just like my grandfather's grocery store was his. It turned into my dad's. I was thinking kind of Sicilian immigrant, like sure. We run one shop. Mm-hmm. So I went and, yeah, I listened to my uncle. You know, I'm very coachable, and you know, I'm a pleaser. I didn't know where I was going to find the hours, but I called a guy by the name of Mr. Ed Wolf, a big realtor here in Houston who just, God rest his soul, just passed away about 6 months ago.
I used to work, Ed Jr. and I were in leadership at Texas Association of Realtors. When I had my brokerages, I know his son very well. And,
right.
So that's interesting. I know exactly who Ed
Wolf is. I have a dish named here called Snapper Wolf.
Oh, and, wow.
Mr. Wolf, he always wanted me to call him Ed, but I'm a Texan, you know, and so we always say that, yeah, I have a hard time calling people older than us by their first name.
That's right.
But so I called Ed up, and he goes, Johnny goes, I got to think about this, man. I think it's a great idea. He goes, but you can't be too close, you can't be too far, blah, blah, blah. We find this location. When he calls me up, he says it's going to take about 2 weeks. He called me back about an hour later, and he goes, I got the location, Woodway and Voss. I said, Mr. Wolf, I said, that location is awful, man. It's been like four restaurants go broke there in 15 years. And he goes, no, Johnny. He goes, we're in five restaurants go broke in 12 years or something. He goes, if you run it the way you run your place on Kirby, he goes, the demographics, I don't even know what demographics meant, but the demographics are wonderful.
Wow.
So we opened up that, and we did very well. So we're running the two restaurants. I had a secret weapon over there. My parents had just retired from the grocery store business, and I asked my mom to go over there, Rosie, and she's been over there every day since then. You know, she took it, and I had a great manager named Marty Reichenthal who opened it up with me, and he ran that. I ran the original, and, you know, and I had a good team. But then where the story kind of gets a little, you know, dicey was we have these two restaurants that are doing really well.
Right.
And I started getting kind of people from the River Oaks district here in Houston call me up and say, Johnny, we'd love to put money into your business and you can grow this thing. But again, I'm still thinking Sicilian immigrant. I don't control freak. I don't want to get too big.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, you know, met with them and didn't really turn me on. I'm not a real money guy.
Yeah.
And they wanted to talk about, you know, returns and all this other stuff. And I just couldn't get to wrap my arms around it. Well, then I had a couple restaurant companies call me. And this is where the story gets interesting, I think. One day, I get a phone call, and the hostess here at the restaurant on Kirby goes, Johnny, there's a Mr. Tim Gannon from Outback Steakhouse on the phone for you. And this is 1993.
Yeah.
This was before we were attached to our phones, and we had texting and all this other stuff, and back then, you'd get a phone call. You get you know, at the end of the day, you'd get message on off a message pad.
Okay.
And I was getting really kind of tired of returning everybody's phone calls because I really wanted to return phone calls. Instead of me saying, I told her, I said, take a message. Mm-hmm. But then I started thinking. I was in the kitchen at the time, and I said, I'm a kitchen guy. And I said, let me go ahead and just get this phone call and knock it and get it out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
About 9:30 in the morning. I get on the phone. Yeah, Johnny, this is Tim Gannon, one of the founders of Outback Steakhouse. He goes, and we'd really like to come down, me and Chris Sullivan, who's one of my mentors now, but we'd really like to come down and meet with you about your restaurant. And I said, Tim, I said, if this is about, you know, franchising, joint venturing, I said, I'm let you know, I'm not really that interested. Thank you for calling me. He goes, well, Johnny, he goes, let me tell you, he goes, I lived in Houston, Texas. At one time, I lived in a garage apartment in West University. He goes, and the people that, my friends that let me borrow their garage apartment, they would take me to eat at Carrabba's all the time. And I loved it.
Wow.
Moving forward, Chris Sullivan had this vision about Outback Steakhouse, and he hired me. I didn't have two nickels to rub together, and I moved to Tampa, and I'm one of the founders of Outback Steakhouse. But Chris Sullivan said, we have about 60 restaurants, public company. We need another growth vehicle. What restaurant do you really love that we can go visit to get in business with? Tim Gannon goes, there's only one place that I'm going to tell you. He goes, it's Carrabba's on Kirby Drive in Houston, Texas.
Wow.
He said, that's the reason I'm calling you. He goes, I understand if you're not interested in meeting with us.
Yeah.
He says, but I kind of come from a school of thought where it never hurts to talk.
Yeah. Wow.
They got on their little private jet. They fly to Houston the next day, their corporate jet, I should say.
Yeah.
And we talked. Again, it's like when I talk to you about people that control your fate.
Yeah.
Tim Gannon would come in. I didn't know him from Adam. I wouldn't know him if you threw him on me.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a customer.
Yeah.
Ralph Minchin was just a customer. Rhonda Lewis at Omni Bank was just a customer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's really the story. So the next morning, Chris and I met. Chris Sullivan, the CEO and founder of Outback Steakhouse, we met at my office, and we made our deal on a piece of scratch paper.
Really?
The 50-50 joint venture. And, you know, since then it's changed. You know, the company has changed, and we can talk another day about, you know, what I think happens to big companies. But I had really good partners at Outback Steakhouse. I trusted them. They trusted me. They had great principles and beliefs. They had great fundamentals. I think we did too.
Yeah.
And Outback Steakhouse at the time was a great company.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. And you know, we opened. I think we got up to a total of about 230 restaurants with them. I was very heavily involved in that. Damon was really kind of headed up the food, and I headed up the cultural part of it.
Right.
And traveled a lot. And so, you know, it started off with, you know, 9 banks turning us down, you know.
Wow. All right. Okay. Got it. Now, how does life change at that point, John? Because now that's literally, that's just, you've gone to a whole different universe now.
So, I did.
So what's that like?
I learned a lot. I learned about, you know, big business, but what I really learned is I don't like big business.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned, I had to do a lot of soul searching, you know, and the soul searching was, who am I?
Yeah.
You know, who am I?
Right.
I've said this, you know, 10 times on with you already, Jason. Hey, man, I can operate a business. That's what I was bred for. That's my DNA.
Yeah.
So I know I'm sounding like I'm repeating myself, but I made a decision to stay at home,
yeah,
raise my children, but I also made a decision that I want to run family-owned neighborhood restaurants, and that's where I'm at now. So right now I have the two original Carrabba's. The Outback Carrabba's have turned into like a royalty agreement.
Okay.
But I have made a decision that, you know, and what I have now is I have the two original Carrabba's.
Yeah.
I have a place called Grace's, named after my grandmother, Grace Mandola.
Yeah.
I have four Mia's. Mia's is named after my daughter, Mia.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two under construction. But I'm not real sure if I'm going to get big.
Yeah.
Because I would much rather be proud than rich.
Yeah.
I love being in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love being on a plane, or I don't love being in an office looking at numbers.
Yeah.
I do my best work is when I'm dealing with my young people.
Yeah.
You know, teaching them and mentoring them.
Right.
I also hold them accountable.
Yeah.
The customers, I love customers, but But I love being with my people. I'm a kitchen guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a hospitality guy.
Right.
And I want to make sure that we teach our young people the fundamentals of this business.
Yeah.
And that's I think I'm a coach.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I want to be a coach.
Yeah. Well, okay. Now I want you to get a little bit philosophical for a minute, because literally in your story, as has been the case with others along the way, you go from your uncle wanting to hire you for that very first general manager position, where you're going, I mean, you're having to deal with kind of the insecurities of, I've never even waited tables, as you said, to now your name is on over 200 restaurants. I've got to believe now you go from, or maybe not, I want to know, does your ego ever come in to go, did you ever sit back and have to battle that? Well, I must be something pretty special, because look at that. I can hop on a private plane now and go to all these different places and go to a restaurant that bears my name. How did you keep that in check?
I'm going to tell you what's really important to me. I think it's the way I was raised. I keep my feet on the ground, you know, and a lot of great things have happened to me, mm-hmm. but I keep talking about this DNA deal or family. Mm-hmm. We're very humble people, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I don't take it for granted. I can get knocked off my throne any day. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you a little story about a father and a son in a second, but I'm proud. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I sit back, maybe. If I sit back and I think about, man, how did this happen? Whatever, but I don't think when you're in the hunt, I don't think you look at the glory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right.
I don't know if I'm making any sense to you.
No, I get it.
I'm face to face with you right now, and I'm letting you know is that I'm proud.
Yeah.
I think it was a long shot. I think we did some good.
Yeah.
But I'm not satisfied.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really not satisfied. I think we can be better.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to give you a story about the way I feel. It's a true story. 7 years ago, I opened up my first Mia's on my Kirby property. You know, I say Kirby, if Houston, Texas, Kirby Drive. Yeah. That's where the original Carrabba's is at. So I want you to understand. You know that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But so I want to develop my property. So I opened up, you know, built a garage, built three restaurants. But one of the restaurants was going is a place called Mia's. And I'm at Mia's 7 years ago, and I'm bussing tables, right?
I love that.
I'm sweeping floors, I want the viewers to kind of understand this and kind of envision this. I see a father and about an 11-year-old, 10, 11, 12-year-old son, and I see the father lean over to his son and point at me. I'm bussing a table with a dish pan, you know, sweeping a floor, whatever I'm doing. And I work my way over to their table. And all I said was, hey, how are y'all doing today? The gentleman goes, he was younger than me, but he goes, Johnny, he goes, my name is Brad. He goes, and I was just telling my son who you are. That's Johnny Carrabba, started Carrabba's restaurant. He said, but what I was telling my son is that's what an owner does.
Amen. I love that.
And I said, thank goodness. Thank God. I said, I thought you were telling your son, make sure you get an education so you don't have to bust tables for a living. But to get to the point of the story, he goes, man, he goes, but you look like you're stressed out and you're working hard.
Yeah.
And I said, Brad, I said, I am working hard. I said, man, I said, this is a new business. I got to make sure it works.
Yeah.
He goes, Johnny, he goes, you have the Midas touch, the golden touch.
Yeah.
He goes, man, I've been knowing you for years. Now, I don't know every one of my customers. I act like I know them, but it's a familiar sure. face maybe,
sure.
right?
Sure.
He goes, Johnny. And I said, Brad, I said, and I was looking out of a window at Mia's, looking at the original Carrabba's. And I said, Brad, I said, you see that building over there? He goes, yeah, it's Carrabba's. That's where I first met you. I said, at the time, Carrabba's was 27 years old. I said, it's 27 years old, and I said, and I'm still wondering if it's going to make it. And so what's the message in that? Mm. is you always have to have fear. So you asked me a while ago, do you ever like sit back and relish?
Yeah.
I'm proud.
Yeah.
But I'm still wondering if it's going to make it. You know what I mean? And I know that sounds kind of ignorant to maybe the listeners or to people that they might say, come on, Johnny, you're just playing a game. No, it's just really is that I'm still in the hunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, no,
but, I'm still in the war.
Well, and the thing is, that's why I asked the question, because it's the answer I expected. Because it's the same thing, if like we mentioned Nick Saban earlier. You think after he's won a national championship, you know, one year, he doesn't think what could happen this year could happen. You know, that's why he continues with success. That's why Belichick that you mentioned earlier, and that's I get it.
It's like this right here. I don't like to, you know, I love Nick Saban, right? Some people say he's overboard. Me, I love it. Let me tell you what happened. He wins the national championship. I think this was 3 years ago. He wins them, you know, all the time, but he wins a national championship. My son and my daughter went to Episcopal High School here in Houston. 2 days after he wins a national championship, my son is taking a picture of Nick Saban. He's recruiting at my son's high school.
I believe it.
Two days after he wins a national championship. And I'll give you another story, is that one day I love college football. I'm watching football. Alabama's beating Nebraska 47-3. I think it was either Nebraska or Arkansas. 47-3, and there's like 48 seconds left in the game. And Nick Saban is ripping a young boy's butt.
Yeah.
Right? Pardon me on that. But
yeah.
I was going to say something else. But ripping him up.
Yeah.
Right? The announcers go, why is Nick doing this? This game is over. Then I have like three of my good friends that went to UT or, you know, wherever they went to school. They're calling me and say, man, your boy Nick Saban. Yeah. I didn't go to Alabama.
Yeah.
But I like the way he coaches. And they're saying, what's he doing this for? I said, hey, he's not worried about this game.
That's right.
He's worried about next week, playoffs, championships, and he's thinking about that young kid who made a mistake.
Yeah.
He's coaching that kid up.
That's right.
And that's the way you almost have to be. If you're not intense or if you're not into it, you know, you're going to start diminishing, and I think that's my fear.
Well, I could not agree more. And by the way, I'm one of those two. I think Nick Saban exudes excellence, and I love to talk about, you know, what he talks about is the process. Every single time it matters. Every single step matters. It's all a part of the process. It's never just about winning a game. It's about executing at that moment your job. And I just think that's just phenomenal.
Listen to me, Jason. You have to listen to this. People want to say, Johnny, what's next? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For one thing, I'm not going to retire. Mm-hmm. I've got too much debt and too much responsibility to retire. But they asked Nick Saban, and I might be wrong, but he has 6 national championships. They asked him, why do you keep going? Mm-hmm. For one thing, he's made commitments to people. But the other thing, what he says, he goes, I would miss the locker room.
Yeah.
I would miss the game.
Yeah.
It's just like me. You know, yeah, I will play golf here and there. I get a part of my life where I don't stay in balance and I work too hard. Mm-hmm. But I love what I do, and I think that if you look at anybody that does what they love, why sell it?
Absolutely.
Why do away with it? Why retire?
And let me, before we wrap this up, because I just want to just, you know, the story has been remarkable, but there's a reason why Outback came to you. I would like to know what it was. I mean, there's something, Johnny, that you figured out at a very early age about operations, efficiency, as you said, the coaching. And the restaurant business, as you mentioned, is so hard because you're dealing with food costs, labor costs. And I got to believe, just because
you're smart, man.
Just because there had been somebody that had been to the restaurant and the food is good, you could say that about a lot of places. I mean, they could have, but there was something that they had seen in your business, not just the product being good, but the operation was sound, and said, this has processes and efficiencies in it that we can duplicate and scale. talk to the listener about where that comes from. And if you're running a business, I don't care if it's a broom factory, an Italian restaurant, what it is that you have executed that have shown, that have yielded those wins.
For one thing, I'm glad you bring this up. First of all, I'm very coachable. I was never really a great athlete or whatever, but I love doing something right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a catcher in baseball. Then I had a guy beat me out. I went to right field, but I still led the team in hitting. But I was I said earlier, I was small, but I was slow. I was a linebacker in football. I went and coached. All along your life, people are going to play a role. My coaches played a big role in my life because all they talked about was the fundamentals. It's all basically blocking and tackling. But there's a system to it. You said something about Nick Saban. He's always coaching the process. Well, I run my business. Even when I was young, day one, I ran my business like my coaches ran their teams. First of all, you got to show up on time. You got to look sharp. My coaches taught us what our uniform was going to look like. It wasn't like the uniform you wanted to put on or the socks you wanted to wear. So I believe in that sort of thing. The other thing is that coaches teach you how to play a position with great fundamentals. They also teach you to stay in your position. As Bill Belichick says, do your job. So when I get so excited, I'm sorry if I'm talking loud in the microphone, but when I ran my company, there was a certain thing that, you know, I was a coach, and I believe in keeping people in alignment. Mm-hmm. Alignment's very important. Discovering what your fundamentals are. My fundamentals are food, service, cleanliness. Atmosphere and ambiance with high morale. I do not coach high morale, though. High morale comes from winning. If we execute our fundamentals of food, service, cleanliness, basically, we're going to win. We're going to have fun. Winning's fun. Losing's not. But I've been saying this since for 33 years. But again, then you have to dissect each position, job duties, responsibilities. And so when Outback approached me, right, Tim Gannon came and spent a week with me. He's supposed to spend a week with me. Mm-hmm. He spent 2 days. He called Chris up. He goes, they're more organized than we are. Mm-hmm. So you said something earlier in this question, right? You said something about you can run a restaurant, you know, and you know, people don't really see it, and you can just go out and just, hey, how y'all doing? Good to see you, and throw the party. What people don't really understand is like in a Broadway play, mm-hmm. they don't understand what's going on behind the stage, behind the curtain.
That's right.
There's so many things. I tell my young people that I try to help along and mentor, there's a lot of work that goes into somebody eating the spaghetti and meatballs.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, you have to order the food. Then you have to cook the food. Then you have to have processes of serving the food. There has to be, you know, the health issues, health, you know, keeping the restaurant clean. But there's a lot of things that go into it. And if you don't have great standards, systems, processes, mm-hmm. you can't get there because you will crumble under pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is not a glamorous business.
Yeah.
You know, everybody watch the Food Network. You know, they think, oh, I want to be, you know, the next, you know, Emeril Lagasse or right. Wolfgang Puck. Right. First of all, you don't know what kind of pain those people went through.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's why I bring it up, because I knew that it had to be that way. Because, again, you know, if somebody's food overruns and their labor's out of whack, you just can't scale a bad business.
Well,
you can't. But yours was one that the product was quality. You had great food, great ambiance, but there was something they saw that was scalable.
Cut me off whenever you're ready.
No, I'm not going to cut you off at all. I want to
cut me off when you're ready.
Yeah, this is
but
good.
But there's a lot of great chefs out there,
yeah.
and they think, oh, you know, I want to open up my own restaurant.
Yep.
And there's a lot of great people out there that have the gift of gab, and they know everybody in the community. And they think they want to open up a restaurant.
Yep.
Well, I'd have to agree that you have to be really good with food to open up a restaurant. I would agree that you have to have a little bit of hospitality in you, the yep. gift of gab, hospitality, whatever you want to call it. But you better also be a great business person.
Yeah.
So it takes to own a restaurant, to own a business, you got to be, you know, you don't have to be great at everything, but you have to know that it's a business. Because I know a guy right now that's the best chef I've ever met. Mm-hmm. But no, my grandmother was the best cook I've ever met. But this, he has a business. He's struggling.
Yeah.
You know why? He only has one dimension.
Yeah.
And I try to tell him this. You only have one dimension to your game.
Yeah.
And he needs to understand what his weaknesses are and get help on those weaknesses.
Yeah.
And he can't make payroll because he's not a good business person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it takes balance.
Well, and you said something there that I have really started to stress. As I've gotten older, I used to think that asking for help and asking for guidance was a sign of weakness until I realized as I got older that no, and it was weird. I would sit on these boards or sit in different meetings where some of the most brilliant people in the room would ask the most questions. And it wasn't until a light bulb finally went off and go, wow, it's not a sign of weakness, but rather it's a sign of confidence and self-assuredness when you're willing to stand up and go, I don't know how to do something, or I'm just not good at this. Show me how, or you do this so that I can go focus more attention on what I'm good at. And it sounds to me like that's something that's been a part of your success, because you said earlier, you're coachable. And if it's something that you shouldn't be doing, you figured out a way, let somebody that's good at it do it.
I'm learning a lot by talking to you today. You know, even off the air, you know, I've gotten a lot out of today. I mean that. I'm working on trying to listen a little bit more. Mm. You know, when you know, but I agree with everything you're saying, but there's one thing that I really believe in. I have some people that work with me that are real smart, and I hope they're not listening to this and they think it's them, but they're real smart. Mm-hmm. But they never really want to ask for help.
Yeah.
My deal is that I talk a lot and I don't listen enough in my meetings, you know, around the company. But there's one thing I always do is I rely on the professionals. Mm-hmm. So God forbid, I don't want to talk about this, but I use this as an example. If I have a heart issue, I'm not going to try to fix it myself.
Right.
I'm going to the best cardiologist that this Houston Medical Center has.
Yep.
Right? And I'm going to put my faith in God and him, right or wrong.
Yeah.
So I don't need to be an expert at real estate. I don't need to be an expert on how to grow a darn tomato.
Yeah.
But always go to the professional.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Absolutely.
And some people are afraid, like, it could be, I'm going to probably get in trouble today, but it could be like marketing. I'm not a marketing genius. Mm-hmm. I have a young lady that works with me that's really good at marketing.
Yeah.
But anytime we get stuck, let's say in marketing, and I'm not a big advocate. Marketing's very important, don't get me wrong. But anytime I have an issue with graphics or marketing, I say, hey, go ask the expert.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really what you need to do.
Yeah.
You know, never be afraid to go to somebody that is the best at it.
Oh, and that's the thing. It took me forever. And to the would-be entrepreneurs or current business owners that are struggling, I can tell you right now, I stymied my growth in the real estate business and from opening more offices sooner. For that very reason, I thought I had to do everything. And I read here recently in, I can't remember which book it was, but it said that if you have an owner or a CEO that is the best person in marketing, the best in accounting, the best in strategy, that's the best of every, then you're going to fail. Because a CEO should never be the best of anything. That's just not, they should be the best at what they're the best at, and that's it, and let the others do it. And it took me forever, Johnny. So I'm an example of somebody who failed in that regard for sure.
Listen to me. I know it. Listen to me. One thing. I barely go to my office. Because that's not my strength. Yeah, I was almost an accountant.
Yeah,
I know accounting. I don't know computers or anything. I can't account for anything really. But I know about how to do that kind of stuff or what it should be.
Right.
My strength. I always know your strength. My strength is being in the restaurant, living on the vision.
Yeah.
Keeping the vision going.
Yeah.
With my people. So you know.
Wow. Well. All right. Here's something that I want to do. I want to end this on a little bit different note than what I normally do with folks, because I think this will be very beneficial to the listener. I got to believe, Johnny, you're the type of person that people prepare an elevator pitch for. If you want to be a restaurant manager, you want to own a restaurant, you want to do something in hospitality at a high level, if you're ever on an elevator with Johnny Carrabba, you better, by God, have your pitch ready for him, because that's a hard schedule to get on, right? But at the stage of life you're in, because you said it earlier, that you've now become a mentor. I want you to give kind of a different elevator pitch of sorts for that young entrepreneur. And I'm not just talking about hospitality or food service. I'm talking about someone right now, either they're thinking about leaving their secure corporate job, which, by the way, one of my another favorite quote is, I just heard this recently about people who stay at a job but really want to get out on their own. The two most addictive things in this world are cocaine and a paycheck every 2 weeks, and the second one will kill you. You know, and yeah, you think
you
about
got, you
that.
Have some good ones, man.
And if you're an entrepreneur, you get that, because how many people out there are living with that dream in their heart, but they're like, but man, that means I don't get that paycheck every 2 weeks, and that's addictive, man. And so I would like for you to
I don't know if this is politically correct or not.
Oh, who cares?
There's two kind of people that can't make any money.
Who's that?
A scared gambler.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A jealous pimp.
So,
but I like yours better, though.
Amen. But what's your elevator pitch for that? You know, somebody that's thinking about stepping out on their own, or they're a young person, they want to, because you hear this all the time, these young people. I go talk to they want to start their own business. What would you
Jason,
tell them?
It's so easy for me to explain this to you the way I believe.
Okay.
Owning your own business isn't for everybody. I know that. But I tell my kids a lot of things. But I'm not a preacher to them, because, you know, I preach at work, but at home I just know I can't overdo it.
Yep. It's hard to be a prophet in your own city. I've learned that too, man.
Right. But what I tell my children is it's not for everybody. It's just the way – this is a personal conversation with me and my two children. Always be in business for yourself. Even though there's a lot of pressure in it, a lot of responsibility, but you control your fate. You might fail, but you control your fate. Mm-hmm. I have seen so many people that have worked for these big organizations from the time they get out of college to the time they get about 50 years old, and the organization says, you're making too much money, and we need to get a younger person in here. Yeah. We're scaling down. I've seen it happen over and over again. I've seen it where there might be a bigger company that has a CEO and they change hands, and, you know, they might go from private equity to public to private equity, and new leadership comes in, and all of a sudden they scale down. They just might not like the way you look. And so this is not for everybody. This is just me, the way I believe. Mm-hmm. Control your destiny.
Amen.
And take a risk. It's I'm not going to say you're making it all the time, but it's worth it.
Love it.
I that's not for everybody, though. That's just the way I believe.
Yeah.
So if you're on the fence, and I'm in this elevator, if you're on the fence,
take a risk.
Be a man or be a woman and take the risk.
Love it.
You know,
yeah.
You don't get anywhere by not taking a risk.
Amen. Amen. Well, Johnny, this has been amazing.
I hope so.
I cannot begin to tell you how grateful I am. Now I owe Brian Clark big time for helping
me arrange this.
But thank you, Johnny. Appreciate you.
I appreciate you. And I tell you, it started off with a podcast, you know, and you know, I feel like I gained a friend today. So,
amen. Likewise.
Thank you.
All right, brother. Thanks so much. Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. Before you go, I would like to ask a favor. Please go out to Amazon.com and pick up a copy of my book, Push Play, Taking Your Life Off Pause. You can either order a paperback or you can actually download it to your Kindle. And I wanted to share with you a little bit of a reading from one of the chapters on Why Not You. And this is where I describe one of my biggest insecurities that maybe you have as well. You know, it's so often that we look out and we see things that are happening in the world. We see people crushing it and doing things that we would love to do. And because they're doing it, we go, yeah, why should I even try? There's already enough of those out there. That's already covered. But in fact, that's not the case. And whenever I told one of my buddies
I really, really wanted to pursue my writing and speaking. He was incredibly encouraging, and he told me to go check out John Acuff. And if any of you have not checked out any of John Acuff's work, I highly recommend it. He is an incredible author. He is an incredible speaker, and I love pretty much everything that John puts out. One of my favorite books of his is called Finish. If you're looking to figure out how to just finish projects and get things done, it's a great book. But anyway, so I start researching John Acuff. And instead of being encouraged, which is exactly what my friend was trying to do, I was like, oh man, this guy's doing exactly what I want to do. And I mean, he's already got a lot of success and he's so far ahead of me. And I sunk into doubt and just insecurity, thinking, wow, well, the world already has John Acuff. They don't need Jason Wright. But here's the reality, and here's what I wrote in the book. My friend was very encouraging and told me I needed to look at some of John's work. I did, and immediately my mind associated doubt with the existence of John Acuff. I watched John speak, looked at his books, and thought, oh crap, there's already a me out there. The world doesn't need me. It has John Acuff. I gave a man who is terribly talented and pretty much living my dream credit for having cornered the entire market of speaking and writing, as though there was no room for anyone else. I immediately realized what I was doing and knew I had to find a way to train my brain to respond differently. Instead of getting down and thinking I could never achieve what John has, I started saying to myself, I have enormous faith that the world needs me to speak when John Acuff isn't available. I trained myself to look at John as confirmation of the need for my work instead of thinking there was no work left for another speaker like me to do. Folks, how many times do you do that? Whatever it is that you want to pursue, whatever it is that you may want to do that seems crazy, that may seem like you're going to tell your friends that you're joining the circus, and that thing, there's so many other people doing it that you go, well, gosh, they would never need me. Well, guess what? They're going to take a day off. They're going to be occupied somewhere else. And when they are, that's when you step in. There is an abundant space for people to pursue their dreams and ambitions and crush it. So with that, please pick up a copy of my book. I'd be grateful. And if you do, please leave a review at Amazon.com. I'd be so grateful. Thanks for listening, folks. Hey, folks, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I wanted to let you know where you can find us out there on the interwebs. You can go to show notes as well as listen to all the past episodes and look for upcoming shows at texttitans.blog. Also, that has all the different formats that you can listen to the show on if you go there. So texttitans.blog. You can also go to jasonwrightnow.com. That has not only a link to the podcast, but it also has a link to my Make Your Own Rules blog that I think you'll enjoy. So please check that out. Also, it has information about my executive coaching business, speaking, and anything else like that. So jasonwrightnow.com. That's literally just my name, jasonwrightnow.com. On Twitter, I'm at jasonwrighttx. I would really appreciate a follow. I have not been a big Twitter user, so I need you guys to help me with that. So please take the time to go out to jasonwrighttx, find me, and follow me. I'm trying to get more active with it. And so if you'll engage with me, I'll try to do a better job of engaging with you. So I would appreciate that. And then on Instagram, I'd really appreciate a follow there. I'm at jasonwrightnow. Again, my name, now. So please follow me on Instagram. And then on Facebook, I'm also at JasonWrightTX. So check us out there. I'm also on LinkedIn, so look for me there. I try to use as many platforms as possible to let you know about upcoming shows, past shows, and then also just anything that I find interesting. I'm trying to push it out and get better with the social media. So please check us out there and follow us. I would be most grateful. And also, please do not forget, it means the world to me for you to go to iTunes, give us a rating. Right now, we've got that 5-star rating. I'm hoping to hold that. Please, please, please. The comments that people are writing are so very kind. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And that's how we keep moving up in the ranks. And right now, we're crushing it with downloads. The show has really had incredible feedback thanks to you guys. So I'm grateful. Please keep that momentum going by giving us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much and have a great day. And as always, I could not be more grateful for you listening. Thanks.